Hey there, this is Radio Statler, streaming live from the Hope Conference in New York. This is Sub here. I got an interview with Adam Savage. Hey Adam, how's it going?
Very good, how are you?
Pretty good. How did you hear about Hope, and what made you decide to come out?
About 2 months ago, somebody emailed me and asked me if I'd be interested in being the keynote speaker here. And I've known about the conference for some time, and knowing that it was in New York, I'm in San Francisco, and we're filming all the time. I started drafting one of my standard, I really wish I could be there, but I can't, letters. And then I happened to look at the calendar and noticed that I was actually going to be in here in New York on this weekend, because I'm doing David Letterman's show tomorrow night, and worked out perfectly. We flew in a day early, which I never mind doing in New York, and I was able to make it.
Awesome. So you're doing David Letterman tomorrow?
We are. Jamie and I are going to go on the show, and we're going to sit on the couch and talk about... I think Shark Week, among other things.
Oh, all right. Sounds like fun. What was your perception of hackers before coming to the conference? Has it changed at all?
No, not at all. I count among my friends a lot of old school hackers from all over the place, MIT, Survival Research Labs, all over Northern California, and worked with guys like that for years. So I'm very familiar with the context and the gene pool, as it were.
Yeah. Got a question from IRC. How do you think hackers should go about getting paid to do what they love?
Well, I think it's the same. I don't think it's any different from anybody else getting paid for doing what they love. When you have a passion for something, you rapidly become much better at it than the average person. You want to understand the totality of it. Understanding of it brings you pleasure, and the more you understand about it, the more valuable you are in the market of needing to actually achieve that. It's the thing that's always increased my market value each time I've tried to learn new skills. And so, to me, being passionate and being obsessive, which are absolutely two primary traits of being a hacker, are generally perfectly suited. Perhaps they could work on the social skills. I know that they're not well known generally, at least some of my friends, for their social interaction skills. But as far as the passion and the skill goes, it's all there.
Yeah. About Mythbusters, did you expect it to take off like it did?
No idea that it would be this successful. We are now 6 years in. We've done about 130 hours of programming. We've busted some 550 plus myths. Over 3,000 explosions, not including internal combustion engines, and we're just about to do a big push of 3 months of new episodes. We had no idea it would be this popular.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely amazing. And I mean, we're still doing the same thing we'd be doing if we weren't doing Mythbusters, which is farting around in the shop trying to figure stuff out.
Yeah. How did you and Jamie come to work on the show?
Well, Jamie and I have a working history that goes the better part of a decade prior to Mythbusters. He gave me my first job in special effects, working as a model maker on commercials for people like Nike and Coca-Cola. And I worked with Jamie for about 3 or 4 years, worked for various other places, and then got up to Industrial Light and Magic around about 1999, worked on Star Wars, AI, Space Cowboys, Galaxy Quest. And then somewhere, I think it was early 2002, Discovery Channel contacted Jamie to find out his interest in being talent on this show called Mythbusters. And he, because he had been interviewed as part of something a few years before, and he expressed that he was interested, that he didn't think he could hold a show on his own, and he gave me a call and asked me if I'd be willing to shoot a demo reel with him. And we did. We shot a demo reel, we sent it into Discovery, and 3 weeks later the camera crew showed up to film Mythbusters, and we have been shooting ever since.
That's really awesome. People were wondering, what's your explosives budget every week on the show?
You know, if we would not be able to do the show but for the good graces of the explosive experts that we work with. First and foremost is Frank Doyle, retired special FBI agent Frank Doyle, who is just a genius and amazing, amazing man. He's got an incredible history with the FBI, an incredible amount of knowledge. He introduced us to J.D. Nelson, the head bomb tech at the Alameda County Sheriff's Bomb Range, where we do most of our blowing stuff up. In fact, it turns out that the bomb technicians all around the country and all around the world are totally simpatico with Mythbusters. In fact, if you look in the U.S. military manual for the type of personality that makes a good bomb technician, Shockingly, it comes very close to reading a description of me and Jamie. Both the exuberance and the curiosity, but with the ability to remain within behavioral and operational norms, while at the same time being very explorative. So whenever we work with the bomb technicians, recently we did with the Anchorage, Alaska Bomb Squad. Jamie and I recently spoke at the AIBTI, Association of International Bomb Technicians and Investigators, down in Louisville, Kentucky, and we have rarely had a warmer reception than from those guys. So most of the time we work with the bomb techs, they handle the expense of our explosives.
Oh, wow, that's
yeah,
that's
and
nice.
That is one of the only things that makes the show possible is their cooperation.
Mm-hmm. When did you know when you wanted to get into special effects?
I think I was like 8 when I knew. I was 11? Yeah, I think I was 11 when Star Wars came out. And that really solidified wanting to... I mean, it was a golden age. Star Wars came out. Battlestar Galactica was on television, and all that stuff was going on. I was building models all the time. And, yeah, working on Star Wars was, I think, the second thing I wanted to do for a living right after being a designer for Legos. And, I mean, getting, almost 20 years later to work on Episode 1, even though it's a, you know... unwatchable piece of garbage. Getting to work on it was total fulfillment of a lifelong dream.
Yeah. What was your favorite episode on Mythbusters to work on?
Hands down, there's several different categories. Episodes that I enjoy watching more than any other, and for that I would say Escape from Alcatraz, an oldie but still a real goodie. Like, I can't believe we got to do that. Then there's episodes in which I think the narrative works well. And by narrative, for me, is the science. I know that bullets fired up and will a penny drop from the Empire State Building kill you when it hits the ground are two of our most scientifically rigorous episodes. And the elegance of the way in which we tell that story is two of my favorite episodes. But hands down, my all-time favorite episode is Lead Balloon, which we just shot last year, and it aired in, I think, early December of 07. Where we built a 14-foot diameter floating helium balloon on a 28 pounds of lead. The technical challenges we encountered and overcame to do that, the editing of the episode, the storytelling, our involvement in getting the totality of that thing in our heads in order to achieve it, I think it's our finest moment. It was on the short list for Emmy nominations, but it did not make it. The list came out yesterday, and we didn't make the list of Emmy nominees.
Mm. What episode would you say is the most challenging that you've worked on?
Yeah, there's a couple. One was Pyramid Power, which is kind of drifts into the oogie boogie of stuff we're never going to go near again, because, like I've said repeatedly, we don't try and prove a negative. One of the most difficult times was building a bridge in order to find out if soldiers marching in step on a bridge can actually cause a fatal harmonic and cause the structure to fail. Scaling engineering challenges like that are notoriously difficult, even for engineers, and for us to take it on was a little bit ridiculous, and I'm still unhappy with the final result.
Yeah. Do you guys still have the jetpack?
Yes. The jetpack not only hangs on the wall, but Jamie still harbors a belief that the only reason it didn't work is because we were trying it in the shop instead of outdoors, and he still wants to get back that 80 horsepower Rotax, strap it on, and try flying again. He still believes that it's possible. I however, feel differently.
Speaking of Jamie, why does he wear the same outfit every show?
Even though my T-shirts change, we both wear the same outfits pretty much every show. I think we both ascribe to, you know how Einstein was supposed to have 7 suits, one for each day of the week, that were identical, so we didn't have to waste time thinking about what to wear. We both ascribe to that. When I find a pair of jeans that works, like these here, I buy 6 pairs at once, and then I don't have to think about them for 2 years until they're so ratty I have to auction them off for charity. When I find boots I like, I buy 5 or 6 pairs of those. The T-shirts take care of themselves. With all my friends with geeky T-shirts and all the fans who send me good black medium T-shirts, I have no end of T-shirts to wear on the show. So all it is what phrase do I feel like wearing today?
Yeah, we got some questions from IRC now.
Okay.
A show about alternative fuel. Have you guys thought about doing anything like that?
Yeah, we've actually done several shows on this. We did a show on free energy over Unity, proving that, Anything that violates the rules of physics is just not going to work, although I don't think that's going to convince any of the crackpots out there who believe it's possible. We also, in an episode called The Great Gas Conspiracy, tried out the classic Joe cell that is supposed to generate enough hydrogen to run a car on. And although we were able to show that you can easily run an internal combustion engine by feeding hydrogen into the carb, even when there's no gas in the engine, the Joe cell didn't produce nearly enough hydrogen to do the same. And in that same episode, we actually played around with biodiesel, which is a fantastic technology, although unfortunately, since it runs on fry grease, I don't think it's necessarily as scalable as people hope, at least not with America running as, you know, if we want America to not be as obese as it is.
All right. So people are asking, would you ever do any shows in Australia?
Yeah, actually, Mythbusters is huge down in Australia. I know that whenever we show a new episode here in the U.S., we get about 1.6 to 2 million people watching. I know that whenever we air a new episode in Australia, we get about 1.6 to 2 million watching. But there's only 10 million people there. We're like getting like Friends type ratings in Australia, and we have a huge fan base. We get a ton of email. And yes, we do have an Australian episode planned. It's just about getting the time to do such an extensive amount of traveling. We went to Africa last year for the Supersize special. Who knows? We may go to Australia next year. But we haven't put it on the books just yet, but we have a whole episode written for it.
They're curious if you would ever try to put together your own program away from the mainstream media.
Discovery's got me on contract for a couple more years at least, and I am loath to kill the golden goose. I will keep on doing Mythbusters until they lock the doors. However, having been freelancer for 15 years, and in freelance all you think about is, no matter how cushy your job seems at the moment, you think, what's next, what's next, what's next? And Mythbusters is no exception. I am always thinking about different media, different things to try. I have no idea what I'll be doing in 5 years. I very much ascribe to an open source work ethic, and you know, if I did do another project after Mythbusters, I'd work very hard to license it under Creative Commons and have you know, whatever inventions we maybe come up with be open source, be you know, fed by the audience, have a real interaction with the audience of the show. I think down all those sorts of lines, but at this point I'm going to keep on doing Mythbusters, and after that, anything's possible.
All right, I think we've got time for one more question. What was your earliest experience with doing experiments, you know, blowing stuff up, and what sparked your interest in the field?
That's interesting. My earliest interest in science doesn't come from doing experiments. It comes from one of my all-time favorite teachers in high school, Dan Frayer, who taught me at Sleepy Hollow High School in upstate New York. I heard that Dan actually just retired a couple of weeks ago, actually. And he was an incredibly inspirational teacher. He really loved the subject that he was teaching. More than that, I would stay after school and talk to him about questions that I had. And I remember with an incredible fondness the seriousness with which he took my... I'll tell you how long ago it was. How long ago it was that he would sit there and smoke in the classroom while I asked him questions. But that was my first interest in really asking questions and trusting my own intuition to ask questions, which is the basis of all science, really.
Yep. Well, thanks again for coming out. It's good to have you here at Hope this year. This is Sub for Radio Statler. I guess we're going to continue on with some normal programming after this, go and put you guys in some talks, maybe some music. All right? Have a good day.
Bye-bye.